So far we've introduced the basic theory and general approach of both the generalized Western psychology methodology versus the Buddhist one. However, just remember, there's always integration. There's always interbeing. And we shouldn't get too caught by the snake. As I was discussing with someone, one problem that could arise is if we are very much aligned with Buddhism and yet not knowledgeable enough about something else, like Western psychology, for example, we may unfairly judge it, misunderstand it. And the reverse, if we're particularly aligned with Western psychology or something else, we don't yet understand enough about Buddhism, we may discredit it. Of the books that I have read about the integration between the both sides, it seems that the author is standing on one side, either not knowing enough about Buddhist practice, psychology, or not knowing enough about Western psychology, and confusing the two while trying to integrate them, which is unfortunate. The world gets to see an incomplete picture and have a messy integration. It's rarer to find someone who understands both worlds, who has experience in both worlds, and can then integrate the two more seamlessly and present a more complete picture while not getting bitten by any snakes. This takes a very open mind. Okay. When the Buddha talked about consciousness, sentient being or living being, especially human being, he used two words to summarize what is that being made of. Two words, remember. To describe a sentient being. Nama, rupa. Hopefully it's spelled correctly. Meaning mind and form. Form, as in substance or matter or form. Could be mind, form, consciousness, or matter. That's the simplest form of the integration of elements which make a living being. However, as soon as we see two words, mind and form, mind and matter, be careful not to immediately get caught by the snake and see mind as consisting merely of mind and form as being merely form, and somehow they're stuck together. Form is within mind. Mind is within form. It's just words to help us analyze sentient being and the function of consciousness. Nama rupa. Nama, yes. Mana is something else. This is the most basic, this is Buddhist psychology. Point one. But just remember, mind and form, and sometimes if we compare science to Buddhist psychology, it may seem there's a conflict, because science, some people claim that science denies that there is spirituality or consciousness. Some people may, who consider themselves scientists, because consciousness, how can you measure it? How can you see it? Or how can you sense it, quantify it, can be denied as just imagination. However, if we were just to open our mind a bit larger, as some scientists do, what's in spiritual communities or religious communities considered consciousness, sometimes scientists may see that as subtle matter. Subtle matter. It's just a word. We may have a reaction. Wait a second, it's not matter. It can't be matter. It's consciousness. It's spiritual. It's mind. It's better than matter. Right? Mind over matter. Mind is better than matter. But that's not the approach. It's a subtler form. Maybe it's not easily measurable. It's a way to open our minds to the fact that form and mind are not separate and distinct. As spiritual people, can we open our minds and consider matter as also a kind of consciousness? That's a mind twister. Is this consciousness? It's just a word. Matter as coarse consciousness. And mind as subtle matter. This may help us to loosen up a bit about words and always remember to be careful of the snake. So from this beginning, from this understanding, we can more safely look at Buddhist psychology in more detail. So have you heard of the teaching of the five skandhas? I can't see you, so you can say yes. Skandhas may be spelled incorrectly. There's a lot of H's in there. I think it's spelled like that. Which means the five aggregates. Aggregates. Or five heaps. You could also say five elements, really. It's the formation of a human being. Five aggregates or things heaped together which create a sentient being. What are the five? Anybody know?
Form
is the first one. Form, again, referring to matter. Form, matter, including the physical body, everything about the body, concreteness of our being, as well as the environment, concreteness of the physical environment, and all the elements of the physical environment. What's usually the second one? Any others know? Have heard of this? The five elements or heaps that compose a living being, especially here, this is a human being. Analyzing a human being. Actually, doesn't only apply to humans, but for our case, we'll talk about humans. Say again?
The mind.
Mind, body.
Mind and body.
Mind form or mind body can then be broken down to five aggregates. So form refers to the nama part. Mm-hmm. The next four refer to the mind part. Mm-hmm. What's this?
Energy. Life force energy.
Not here.
Sensations.
Sensations or feeling. Feeling refers to the emotional elements, the emotional functions of mind, our emotional side. Actually, this is part of this is mirroring what we talked about in Western psychology.
But isn't nama the same as mind? Because it here says nama.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry. Rupa. Thank you. That would be utterly confusing. I'm confusing myself. Apart from our emotional side, what else do we have? We talked about earlier.
Intellect,
the rational side, which is made up of these elementary particles of what we call perception. You folks see over there?
It's also part of the understanding of our mind. This thing, the five elements.
This is the basic. And this is basic Buddhist psychology of body-mind. Perceptions refer to when we contact things, we have a function to create an image in the mind, followed by language, naming. Okay, so for example, well, what is this? Hand, right?
Five.
It's five. Okay. For you, it's a hand. For you, it's five. High five? Oh, okay. So depending on our contact with some kind of phenomenon, we have an immediate reaction to name, to label. This is perception. One kind of perception. Next. Okay, fast reaction. When we have various perceptions, when we have various feelings, we'll also have a volition or intention to do something. You see a hand, maybe someone will be like, tch.
Yeah.
Or you were gonna wave to them, but they gave you a high five. Your perceptions and volitions were a bit different. But volition is the intention.
Is it also related to this word will?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Related to will, intention. This is related to doing and acting. And related to, in Buddhism, what's called karma. All of our doings, all of our actions, and the momentum that generates is will to do something. It doesn't just come from thin air. It accumulates, develops. This is sometimes called mental formations, which is actually a very broad category. Mental formations. Yesterday we said everything is a formation, right? Mental formations is referring to these various things that arise in the mind based on different conditions. It's a formation, mental formation.
Volition
is a mental formation.
A, but not only.
Right.
Okay.
Perception is a mental formation. Feelings are mental formations. However, here they're singled out just because they're so dominant in our experience. Emotion, so dominant in our everyday experience. Perception. Okay? They're general, very dominant mental formations. So they're singled out here. And what's the last one, usually listed as? Before that, yeah, before we get into that part, it is consciousness. This can be a little tricky because, wait a second, for this section, unless you catch me making a mistake again, please hold your questions, the immediate questions. Things will gradually unfold. This is just a process of unfolding. Unless you didn't hear something or I mixed it up, let's just absorb, take notes. We'll explore. Mm-hmm. Consciousness, in general, refers to the ability to be aware in all sense of the word. The ability to be aware includes the ability to see, because we have to be aware of something. It doesn't mean consciousness is this thing floating in space. Buddhism doesn't talk about just this somehow isolated consciousness that we need to find or become. There's no such thing. That's imagination. That's a mental formation. Consciousness just refers to the ability to be aware of something. The ability to see objects, the ability to hear sounds, the ability to what? Smell, the ability to touch, the ability to taste, the ability to think, remember, cognize. That's all included in consciousness. And you know what? Because of consciousness, all these other mental formations and even the ability to perceive form is included in consciousness. So again, as we separate things for the sake of understanding, remember that all of these things are completely integrated, cannot truly be separated. Just like it would be ridiculous to say that the leaf is separate from the trunk of the tree, right? Isn't that ridiculous? The leaf could be without a tree, it doesn't need the tree. Or the trunk doesn't need the leaf. Maybe that's easier to believe. The trunk doesn't need the leaf. But actually, what would happen if the tree never had leaves? There'd be no way to absorb the energy from the sun. So a lot of its nutrients. There'd be no tree. So all of these, remember that they are integrated. This is interbeing. Without consciousness, there's no feeling, there's no perception, there's no volition. Without form, how can consciousness even function? How can it reveal a function without form? Okay, I'm going to erase this now. This is the foundation of what we're exploring today. We're going to get more into the different aspects of consciousness now. The form part, Buddhism doesn't get too much into because it's not about dissecting the body. It's really about exploring how the consciousness functions. This next part will be a little more fun. I'll draw a picture. Try to map, give us a visual map of consciousness. I haven't seen this before, I just invented it. I mean, it's nothing special, but I thought it could help you understand and be easier to remember than just a whole slew of words. So when Buddhism talks about consciousness, as we mentioned, so far there are six obvious functions of consciousness: seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking. And these are the elementary levels of consciousness talked about in many of the teachings of the Buddha, so-called early teachings, we'll call them that for now. Teachings which appear in the agamas or the nikayas. There's also functions of consciousness. Someone mentioned before, your name is Sara, right? You talked about store. Yes, it's in my storage. She mentioned store, the ability to store. And many of you have read the book, so this is kind of review. Consciousness has an ability to store. Let's draw consciousness. This feels interesting. We're drawing consciousness. Represent consciousness as this cell, particle. This cell, the size, we don't have to worry about the size. It's like a storehouse. Consciousness is sometimes described as having the function of a storehouse, like a warehouse, ability to store all kinds of what? First of all, if we just said it was a storehouse with nothing in it, what kind of storehouse has nothing in it? Even the empty storehouses are used for like raves and parties and things. So technically, they still store things, have a function. There would be no such empty storehouse. That's kind of like the consciousness that's independently existing somewhere apart from everything. That's imagination. One level or function of consciousness is called store consciousness, sometimes referred to as the eighth consciousness. Just think of it as the eighth function of consciousness, or the eighth function of mind. Again, try not to see it as some separate consciousness. Its function is to store seeds. You could draw along with me. See a few of you who like to draw. This is hopefully engaging for you. What kind of seeds? Where do the seeds come from?
Experiences.
Impressions
or insights.
For example? And we felt it before, right? Hot fire.
Smile and you are beloved.
Right. So some seeds come from our present experiences. Touching fire, we know it's hot. If someone says, fire is hot, don't touch it. When we're kids, we're probably like, fire is hot. What does that mean? Right? We want to explore and experience it, because hot means really not much until we experience what's called hot. Once we touch it, if we get a really bad burn, will we forget that? Experiences, all of our sensory experiences, including our experiences of emotion. It's not just sensory on a level of what we see and hear. Feelings we've had. What about volitions, intentions we've had, motivations we've had? They're kept in storage. Perceptions, the ideas that we've had about things, of course. The idea of hot, we need to know what that's connected to. It's got to be connected with the right thing. If the idea of hot is connected with the feeling of cold or the contact of cold, that can be troublesome. So the organization of and proper storage of seeds is in store consciousness. It stores them, it maintains them, it prevents them from becoming jumbled and confused. And it's also described as store consciousness is like a magnet which is drawing in iron particles. It's another vivid imagery. Do you ever see that? A magnet with the iron particles, it just draws things in, keeps it, maintains them. So seeds refer to, remember this, it's not only perceptions. Seeds refer to all mental formations, all experiences, from feelings, perceptions, volitions, sense contact impressions. Everything is stored within consciousness. And we call that store consciousness. Another level to this, actually, is that according to Buddhism, when we are born, we don't just start with a blank slate of consciousness. In many different ways, we inherit seeds from our ancestors and from our, we can say, our own lineage of self. Someone had a question about reincarnation. We'll address that later, but it's connected to the inheritance of seeds over generations. So everything is stored here. Also, to get to your question, Sylvia, the capacity for things, we could say the potential for suffering, we could say is a kind of seed. It's a potential. When we say seed, it seems like very concrete. It's like, how could suffering be like a seed? It's just a little speck. But we must remember that seed is, again, a word to describe the potential that we have within the mind as well. The potential for suffering or the potential for insight or enlightenment is also described in this school as a seed of consciousness. Is everybody with me so far? Everything is stored in consciousness, which may be initially confusing at first. Even the potential for body, environment, in addition to all the seeds of mind, the potential for the manifestation of form in terms of body, in terms of the world, is also stored in consciousness. The potential to have this physical body or that physical body or that body is a product of the seeds of store consciousness. The fact that we have this space as opposed to that space upstairs is also a maturation of the seeds of store consciousness. This may be really hard to grasp at first, but later it becomes much clearer. Again, don't get caught by matter and consciousness as being separate and distinct. It becomes much clearer. Even the ability to be mindful, the ability to practice and be mindful, not just think about all this stuff, the ability to be mindful of the seeds within our consciousness and the ability to transform these seeds, this practice of mindfulness, is also described as a seed. Again, it's another potential. There's a potential for mindfulness. There's also a potential for lack of clarity, confusion. It's also a potential. Just like yesterday, we said the mind can either be confused or it can be awakened. It's not that we're gaining something and then all of a sudden we have enlightenment, or we get rid of something and then we're happy and free. It's the same consciousness. It's just being used differently. So the difference lies in how that potential is developed, utilized. An analogy that's often used is the mind or consciousness is like a knife. What's something wholesome that a knife can be used for? To butter toast. Or? Spread Nutella.
Surgery.
Helping people.
Getting someone.
Well, that's not so wholesome. Yeah, we're talking about the wholesome things first. What we consider wholesome. Opening a bottle of beer. Making a sculpture. Many different things which can be used which create benefit of some sort. Again, some of the cases can be relative. Unwholesome things to be used to be done with a knife could be killing someone. Okay, again, relative situation. Yeah, depends on the situation. Okay.
No, we were discussing about the circumstances.
Right. Scratching someone's car. No, I just thought of it. Never done it.
So you were, one of the things, the words that came to me, because it's quite interesting, the collective sense of is when, you know, the seeds fructify in us. Like, for example, you were saying mindfulness doesn't just happen by hearing about mindfulness. Through constant planting of seeds, it's at some point we reach a critical mass where mindfulness manifests.
We'll get into that in a bit, in terms of developing the seeds. But in general, just to get the point across, whether you think it's wholesome or unwholesome, the mind can be used for this or for that. It can be used to create suffering for oneself or others. It can be used to relieve suffering, bring happiness. It's the same consciousness. There's no magical implants, or there's no destruction of something. So the term transformation is often used in this school. Transformation. In the same way that compost, or let's just say trash. In some sense, we think trash is dirty, stinky. We don't like it, we don't want to smell it. But trash, if managed and used properly, can be transformed into food. Compost can be used to fuel, fertilize the fields, produce food. Again, it's an analogy. Don't get too nitpicky with plastics and pollutants and things. Maybe someday we'll be able to compost them more readily. But the same material, which at first seems just like trash, useless, problematic, through transformation becomes nutritious, life-giving. This is the analogy that helps us to understand the seeds of the mind and how the potential to transform seeds of suffering into fruit of insight is possible. Everybody with me so far? Not too difficult to understand, I don't think. From this base of what's called store consciousness, all of the functions of the mind arise. Basically, consciousness has many functions, or many potentials. All of them arise from here. So, by the way, we're going backwards from what's called the eighth function of consciousness to the first, from the base upwards. So again, to visually get this in perspective, I first imagined a cell, or I tried to make the ocean into a circular shape, kind of like the globe. So imagine the ocean, a circular ocean, spherical. On the surface of the ocean, everything arises. Where do waves arise from? Waves arise from the ocean. Waves don't come from empty space. So all the functions of consciousness are like waves arising on the surface of the ocean. This is a global ocean. The first wave, what's considered the seventh function of consciousness, is described as manas. Manas, what's the word for hand in Spanish or Italian? Mano? Mano. Manas means grasping consciousness. Grasping, like your hand grasps onto something. Manas, think of the root of the Latin language is some Sanskrit, yeah? Grasping consciousness. What is it grasping? Because we said consciousness always has an object. So it's something to be aware of, to be grasping. Manas is the function of mind that grasps onto the sense of self. Our sense of self, again, just doesn't come from empty space. Sense of self is a function of constant grasping at a tiny piece or seed of our store consciousness and taking it to be a self. Let's draw a little hand here. A hand grasping onto a small portion of the content of the mind. Remember we talked about that? Identifying with the content of the mind. This is the function of identifying with content of the mind as self. Not just once. This is to make it more organic. Now in the picture it's hard to see, but imagine this is animated. Everything here is constantly moving, including all the seeds in store consciousness. Everything in the ocean is moving, floating, transforming. Everything. There's nothing here that's static. The function of grasping is also continuously grasping. Not just once, let me just grasp it and put it back. It's more like this. Seventh consciousness. Where am I? Here I am. Here I am. Here I am. Here I am. Kind of frantic, obsessional, constant grasping onto content in order to create the sense of I'm still here, I'm still here, I'm still here, I'm still here. There's a teacher in our lineage of my teacher. His name is Simon Child. He had a very funny description of this process. He said it's kind of like the mind saying, me, 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 me. Me, always referring to creating the sense of self. It's not just me. If it was me, then it would be gone, be past. It's me, 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 me. So fast, it seems like the me is constant. That's how the sound is sustained, right? We continuously produce sound. Otherwise, sound is gone. Me. Me, 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 me. So we're all walking around every day thinking about a lot of things, but underneath that it's me, 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 me. You think it would be tiring to do that all day with your voice? That'd be tiring? Let's all do it together for a few seconds. Ready? Me, 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 me. This function of grasping consciousness, doing this constantly, is itself tiring. Sometimes attachment is described as chen lao, which means exhausting, dusty. It's like dusty, confusing, and exhausting. That's a good illustration of that function, which is always working subtly in the background. This is where the basic sense of self arises. However, that's the subtle form of self-grasping. When self-grasping manifests on the surface, what does that look like? We would say that's the next wave. That's the sixth function of consciousness, to discriminate. It's also referred to as mano-vijnana. Pardon my spelling. Often referred to as just the discriminating consciousness or discriminating mind. What's the discriminating mind? Well, that's just all the perceptions, the name and form, the names we give things. Since we have the sense of self, there's definitely going to be other selves. Once we self once, we'll self everything else. So we have me, we have you, we have this, we have that. We have markers, we have trees, we have cars, we have garbage, we have flowers. All of those names and perceptions that surface and that we also grasp onto are the more superficial layer and arise from the function of manas. So the fuel for the discriminating mind that we use every day to function, the obsessive discrimination that we find it very difficult to let go of, it's fueled by that grasping. It's born from that. So this is where the seeds come from, the store consciousness, and appear in the surface consciousness. All the things that we never knew we had down in there until they come into our mind, from storage, they're brought to the surface, they're brought to the cashier. So did you ever have that thought in meditation? It's shocking. It's like, whoa, I can't believe I just thought that. Where did that come from? Oh, I must have seen it somewhere. I must have seen it in a movie. That's why I was thinking about it. Who knows where it comes from? It comes from our outside experiences, contact with so-called outside objects. It can also come from the maturation of seeds within our imagination, things forming together, more so internally, and then manifesting. So when the seeds come to the surface, they surface in this mano-vijnana, or discriminating consciousness, also called mind consciousness, but mind is used a lot, so discriminating consciousness. And as mentioned before, when we're mindful, mindfulness also manifests as that, not as discriminating consciousness, but it's still a formation or a seed from, say, the storage or potential from store consciousness manifests as the ability to be aware of an object clearly, consistently. That's mindfulness, right? To be aware of something. It's always mindfulness of something. You can't just say, just mindfulness is there. You know? I want to be more mindful just by, you know, just be mindful, I guess. You know? Let's all be mindful at the same time. If someone hasn't learned or practiced mindfulness before, it's like completely groundless. How can you just be mindful without being mindful of something? So the ability to be consistently, clearly aware of the object of consciousness, that's mindfulness. That's also a function of mano-vijnana. Just in case this analogy doesn't work of the ocean and the waves, it can also be described as a field with seeds in it, a giant field with seeds. The field is store consciousness. The seeds are the objects or the materials within that field. The sixth, mano-vijnana, is the gardener, like mindfulness, choosing which seeds to develop, choosing which seeds to water, choosing to water wholesome seeds. That's a skillful gardener on the path of practice. Choosing to water the unwholesome seeds, or being very unaware that we are watering unwholesome seeds, confused, distracted, that's when we haven't yet learned to practice. That's a drunken gardener.
Which what was the definition of the gardener? The other one?
Mindfulness?
The gardener represents this mano-vijnana, this sixth consciousness. The ability to be mindful, the ability to plant the seeds, to nurture the seeds of mind, to nurture all these things, potentials that we have. Store consciousness just maintains them.
Can we have a transcription?
Sure, if it clarifies something already here.
So just the statement that you mentioned, that the mindfulness decides to nurture the seeds. And if we are mindful, we nurture the good seeds, which will give the good benefits. So this means, from Buddhist principle, we are already
dividing our seeds of our consciousness into good and bad. Is it true?
Remember not to be caught by the snake.
But if we are saying being mindful, mindfulness will only will decide to nurture what kind of seeds.
Hmm.
So when we say kind, we are already having a categorization.
Of course. Otherwise, how would we know how to practice?
So that means we don't treat everything as on the same level. We have a...
Remember, remember garbage and flowers.
Yeah, but it's also a perception. A garbage, if I perceive the garbage to be a useful, then it can also be a good fertilizer.
So ultimately, it's not bad.
Then I nurture all the seeds with equal awareness. I don't decide. Just I'm trying to understand.
I see what you're saying, sure. Just keep this in mind. The distinction between wholesome and unwholesome is made to give us a direction in the practice. We don't want to divide things into ultimately good and ultimately bad. Because through mindfulness, through proper gardening, the unwholesome or the bad can be transformed into what brings about the release of suffering, what's considered wholesome. It's words, it's making distinctions, but this is what we do. This is how we find direction. So it may be challenging, but try to hold that. Try to be mindful of what you are struggling with for now, and we'll continue. Yeah? It's okay. It's okay to disagree. It's okay to not understand. And hold on to that. In the same way that stored consciousness stores everything. Through this process, we encounter difficulties. Be mindful of that too. And see if it transforms through your own gardening. That is, if you choose this garden. If you choose a different garden, that's okay too. So what we talked about so far is probably more of the abstract and more difficult to grasp aspects of this teaching of Buddhist psychology. The next waves of consciousness, so to speak, are easier to understand. What we talked about is grasping consciousness. Drew a little hand there. Then discriminating consciousness. I'm going to draw a brain here. This is the function of mind that makes many, many distinctions. Although the function is mindfulness is also a part of this, a brain as an organ is also a big part of this level of consciousness. Again, consciousness cannot be separated from form. Just like when the brain is damaged, there will be difficulty making proper distinctions. It's undeniable. So we're not saying that the body is just there like a machine and all this consciousness is just happening without it. Form is all here. This entire chart includes form. Okay? The other five are the consciousnesses of sight, hearing, smelling, tasting. What else?
Touch.
Did I leave one out? Sixth sense, not just the brain, but it's pictured using a picture of a brain. This includes the what's called mind consciousness, is the discriminating thinking function of consciousness. We just said before, labeling and perceiving, naming. Consciousness has these functions. Form is within this consciousness. These are all the levels of consciousness that Buddhist psychology describes. From the ability to store and the content of what's being stored, all of our potential, from wholesome to unwholesome. Or there's also something described as neither wholesome nor unwholesome. It's to be determined. It's called indeterminate. Sometimes a seed could be wholesome. Sometimes it's not. Maybe if we have, for example, if we have a very strong personality, prone to arguing, being forceful, depending on the circumstances, that forcefulness, that argumentative quality could create conflict, could create discord. However, in the right situation, that powerful, strong-willed personality can protect people from being harmed. Then it becomes so-called wholesome. And we can see transformation working, also independence on conditions. So the part that we won't get to today is actually more in detail of how it analyzes conditions and how everything that's here, depending on conditions, it may manifest in a different form. Could be wholesome, leading towards freedom, liberation of mind. Could be unwholesome, leading towards more suffering, more anxiety. It could lead to neither, stagnation. Up to this point, this is a basic introduction to the 8 functions of consciousness. Is everybody basically here so far? Yeah? Okay. Again, to remind us of the interbeing of all of this, it's drawn as like a cell, or a giant ocean cell, we could say. But where is it? Is store consciousness like, is my store consciousness mine? And then your store consciousness is completely yours, and that's just the way it is? Or is it store consciousness is inside somewhere, and everything else is outside? You may know the answer. It's quite simple that we cannot completely define store consciousness or consciousness as being either completely inside or completely outside. My store consciousness is not completely mine. Your consciousness is not completely yours. Why? Because of the complete interpenetration or interbeing of everything. How could we have any seeds within our store consciousness if there weren't so-called objects on the outside? Put it in quotes. Outside. Objects such as a tree. If we had no object which we perceive as a tree, no object to contact, we would have no ability to have a seed of the image of tree, right? Where would impressions come from if there were no objects to contact? Just like, I don't know, do you consider yourselves intelligent people?
In the kindergarten version.
It's undecided.
Undecided?
Sometimes.
I don't know, maybe I'm also undecided as well. Just a moment. Whether we consider ourselves intelligent or undecided or uneducated, or maybe some people would say I'm dumb, where does all of our knowledge come from?
Social norms.
Society. Who taught us?
Someone said that nothing exists outside of you, and all of those outside objects that you described, like trees or I don't know, many others, it's not really existing outside of you. And I would say for sure, my opinion is that it doesn't matter if there is something outside of you or if there is not, or if there is anything outside.
have no way to really know what is outside of me, never mind how you define me, because all what I perceive as outside reality goes through the filters of my vision, feeling, thoughts, who knows where they come from, and feelings, who knows where they come from. So I have no really way to know what is outside of me.
Okay. Okay, before we get there, that's sort of jumping ahead a bit. Before we get there, who told you that?
I read this idea.
Okay.
I identified with it, I related to it in this kind of very...
Okay, yeah, thank you. It resonates with you, yeah?
Yeah.
But you read it somewhere, just like all of us, including myself. I first read this somewhere. It wasn't born in isolation. It didn't manifest in isolation. What's inside our intelligence, our experiences, our abilities cannot be separated from what's called outside. Inside, outside, again, they're concepts, just like good and bad are concepts. So what it's trying to illustrate, while trying to map the mind and map the functions of the mind, to always remember that those distinctions are arbitrary, are not complete, cannot describe the reality of consciousness. But we try our best. And then we break down the barriers by remembering what's outside creates and forms what we consider to be inside. What is inside influences and forms what's considered to be outside. Your consciousness completely affects my consciousness. My consciousness affects your consciousness. We've just been affecting each other's consciousnesses for the past 2 days. I cannot claim ownership for anything that I've said. Complete 100% ownership for the content of what's in my consciousness. This is the teaching of interdependence. So it'd be really cool if this was animated. It would make it much easier. Do you ever see in science class or just in videos of how a cell functions? How cool is that, huh? It's like we look at... Yeah. Or have you seen the actual microscope footage of a sliced cell that's still working? And you see the water and everything traveling through the cell wall? How cool is that? That is amazing. What looks like from the naked eye just a impermeable thing is actually permeable. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, you've been waiting a long time, sure.
I have another question. Another question that popped up. Do you also believe that there is a universal consciousness somewhere in the vacuum? Because they say that no information is lost as per quantum physics also. So whatever I'm saying, it is getting stored somewhere. And is it like universal consciousness maintaining that? Does Buddha believe that nothing live by and nothing dies? I don't know how to say it, not die, but it's called about consciousness.
Hmm. Right, so in Buddhism there is no idea of a separate universal consciousness.
Okay.
Somewhere in the background, mm-hmm. where everything else is in the foreground happening. Other traditions may recognize that, but in Buddhism, consciousness is completely participating and cooperatively formed or integrated in everything. Consciousness is always conscious of something.
So no collective consciousness is something that is obvious.
Well, I mean, in the book that you're reading, what's called collective consciousness actually just referred to the things that are shared among all of us. Shared ideas, shared behaviors, things that are mutually influencing each other. It's called collective consciousness. But it's contrasted with individual consciousness because, for example, even though we all speak English here, right? We all speak English. We could say that's part of our collective consciousness. We share this ability to speak English. However, everybody comes from a different place, has learned the language in a different place, has different slang, different sayings, maybe like slang from New York, you know, coffee, New York. That's New York. That's something part of my individual part of my English language that we could say is a bit more individual consciousness.
That would be so great.
I go in a closet and I speak with that accent. My accent actually used to be more like that until I left the States for a while. It slowly transformed. The seeds of seeds of New York and pork in my car slowly transformed into, you know, I'm gonna go park my car. Huh?
Yeah, the accent hasn't changed from yesterday also.
Did it? Okay, wow, perceptive. So I'm absorbing your collective Berlin or group seeds of English language. So again, whether it's collective, shared, or individual, it's never purely collective nor purely individual. Those concepts eventually have to be thrown out. Tatiana had first. Okay, but before we continue in this vein, Buddhism, well, the Buddha's insight was that to affirm that there is some kind of separate consciousness, independent and somehow pure, apart from all of this, is, according to his insight and the insights of others, imagination. It does not exist. Again, it's not so much asserting a new doctrine, but breaking down the doctrines of thinking in terms of consciousness, matter, universal consciousness, and then mortal consciousness. It's slashing those views. Mm-hmm. Saying that it's all consciousness, just different functions, different ways of manifesting. And the most important thing, again, so we don't get caught by the snake, is how does this apply to practice? How does this guide us on the path of practice? That's the reason why this was designed and explained, so that when a person is using the method, mindfully observing their experience, they can more easily identify, oh, this is what's happening. Aha, I see, this is what's happening. After the fact, or before the fact. Not sitting there thinking, wait a second, I can feel manas, I can feel it. Wait a second. You know, Or there you are again, Manovijnana. You know, that's interfering. This is the map. When we walk, we walk. Tomorrow would be, hopefully, we have, I think, will make the opportunity for us to do more of this practice. Basically introduce mindfulness and then we'll do it, which you have, many of you do already. But with this map informing the practice of mindfulness, you'll find that it transforms with the proper direction, with how to point your mind in the practice, we'll be able to transform suffering into insight, transform confusion, scatteredness into mindful clarity, taking our seeds or our garbage, transforming it into flowers, food. Is this heavy? So we've put some of us to sleep.
Just explaining to you.
But again and again, when we read these things, when you, if you have interest to go back and read the book, again, look at it as an instruction manual as opposed to a description of reality. If we look at it as a description of reality, we get caught again and again, and our mind will be, ah! If we look at it as an instruction manual, we just, we apply it. It becomes much easier, much more natural. Again, you don't necessarily have to use such a detailed map, and I'll talk about that when we talk about Chan or Zen. It sort of simplifies everything into the most readily absorbable, digestible material. That's also a way. So this is not for everyone. This is not for everyone, this approach, this way of mapping the mind. However, now that we've basically mapped the functions of the mind, I think it's important just to briefly describe, as Chris, you asked yesterday, how does really ignorance, how does it really work? And then to go along with that, then how does insight and awakening really work? How is it described here? Now that we have all the basic tools understood, this is what we have to work with, our eyes, ears, nose, tongue, our whole body, and our whole consciousness. We said yesterday that ignorance depends a lot on, not a lot, ignorance comes about because of our misperception, inaccurate perception. And what does that mean? So right now we'll talk about modes of perception. Can I erase this? Does anybody want to take a picture of this funky looking thing? The little prince planet? The little mountain and thing? Yeah. What else do you see? Anybody else see something else?
A cat.
A cat.
Yeah.
A cell. Flower. A sun. Yeah. The perceptions that you just identified, where are they showing up? At this moment, where are they showing up? Here, right? This is the function of discrimination. Where are they coming from? The seeds.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if we were really sure, no, it's a cat. No, it's a sun. It's a little prince. This is a very heavy sense of what? Grasping. Duck feet. Yeah, Today is the day of stirring up all kinds of questions, but it's good to keep ones that are essential for now. Let them be in your store. And they will transform through mindfulness.
Yeah.
it may be hard to hold them, but we can't possibly get through everything without addressing all of them. So this is part of the work. Confusion is actually can be a very useful motivation. And no matter what answer any of us came up with, sometimes it doesn't resolve it. Okay, so modes of perception. In terms of manifestation only teachings, it talks about three modes of perception, three ways in which consciousness is aware of its objects. Does this ring a bell for those of you who read the book? So again, we said there's no such thing as consciousness without an object. Consciousness we can describe as the subject, the thing that's, or the ability to perceive. You could describe it as subject. Object is the thing that's perceived. The two coming together create consciousness. It can't be consciousness just kind of hanging out for a while, and when it decides, it comes out and grabs an object and identifies it and then goes back in. Which we may get the feeling that that's what our mind is. My mind, it's just always there, and then it's kind of coming out and then going back in. The teaching is that any subject, for example, sight or seeing, sight doesn't happen unless there is the subject of seeing, for example, the organ of the eye, the object of sight. We could call it a tree. It's that form, that thing that's perceived. We'll just call it that for now. When the two come together, when there's this totality of interbeing, we have seeing. We have consciousness. Subject and object, again, we name them as such, but because of interbeing, interpenetration. It's really one totality. Consciousness is always consciousness of something. This is just one example of the function of consciousness. So, what's the mode that we were just functioning in when everyone said, oh, it's a tree, it's a sun? Anybody remember what that mode of perception is described as? Well, we would call that, the mode would be inference, inferring, naming, labeling, all of those things we were just doing. You saw something, but also there was an image that came to mind. And a label was given. That's referred to as the mode of perception through inference, discrimination. If we went home today and you're thinking about, that was an interesting chart David drew today. Sort of looked like a ball of slime, sort of looked like this and that. What would that mode of perception be then?
Memory.
Memory. It'd be pure memory, because at that point there's no physical form object that you're contacting with your eyes or your sight. It's coming up again from your storage. What we're seeing there is actually completely based on images. It's actually referred to as erroneous. Completely false. Erroneous.
Is a mode of perception.
The mode of perception. What we're seeing at that time is actually completely removed from the reality of the present moment.
For example, memory.
Mm. Or if you have a dream.
Yeah, memory, a dream. It's no longer any reality that's in front of you that you're contacting. It's purely from the seeds stored in store consciousness that's being conjured, images. If we were to just look at the board without deciding what it looks like, without describing it, or, you know, looking at this thing, simply, purely looking, without adding anything extra, what do you see? You can't answer. If you did, it would be right here. Discrimination, inference. What do you see? Just look. Take a few moments. It's possible that when we perceive, we're conscious of something without adding any labels, discrimination, ideas, without superimposing any previous experiences, that we have a direct perception. A direct perception of what? You just see whatever is possible to see. Is it ultimately a tree or not? Actually, that's not the question, because if we decide it's a tree, that's still the second mode, that's inference. You know, outside, we conveniently have some, if you want to take a look. If we decide it's a tree, that's discrimination, still interference of discrimination. It's not so clear seeing. Direct perception would just be to look. And our eyes can only see so much. You know, this is, of course, Buddhist psychology acknowledges, our eyes can only see so much, our ears can only hear so much, right? Can we see infrared light? We can't. Can we see UV light? We can't. There's a lot that we can't see with our eyes. However, as long as there's no interference of discrimination, superimposing, projecting images, the perception is direct. And we're in touch with the reality of that moment of consciousness, of subject, object, without even thinking of subject and object, just a direct experience of what is. So briefly, Buddhism calls that suchness. It's just such. It's just as such. It's just like that. No concepts, no ideas, nothing extra. Inference is adding ideas onto what we see at this moment, called the realm of representations. If it's completely imagination, it's called this field of mere images. To conclude, because time is here, ignorance and all of our confusion and suffering is because we live so much and we are so attached to these realms or these experiences. We see things completely clouded by representations, by images. Our mind is cluttered constantly, projecting things, drawing things from our store, making things cloudy. Insight or awakening is to be able to perceive directly. Doesn't mean we never think. That's also one thing to be sure of. Of course, we have to think. But when that is functioning, we're completely aware of the process of thinking. There's no confusion. There's no grasping. There's mindfulness. There's also peace. There's also compassion. When perception is direct, that's wisdom. That's insight. When it's erroneous, inferred, confused, that's suffering. If we are truly mindful for one moment, that moment we touch suchness, we experience insight. For the moment that we are unmindful, well then, we suffer. So tomorrow we'll talk about now mindfulness, the path, the practice. Enough of all this super heady stuff, and we'll practice together. And whatever you can extract from today, you know, even this much makes the path very clear, makes our practice of mindfulness much more clear and simple. And thank you everyone for your patience today.